go ahead.
So we're going to call the meeting to order, a special meeting of March 25th, 2019, and I want to thank Andy Costa for agreeing to attend and speaking to us about some of the issues that that we had heard in our last meeting. So I'm just going to open it up then in calling the meeting to order and ask you to go ahead and begin in any way that you'd like.
All right. Well, thank you for the invitation to be here. And for those who don't know me, I am, in fact, Andy Kossover, and the Ulster County Public Defender since 2000. In addition to that, I'm somewhat familiar with all the current criminal justice legislation pending in the state of New York, because for the last 10 years, I have been the legislative chair of an organization, statewide bar association, if you will, of criminal defense lawyers entitled the New York State Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers. And we have over 1,000 members in the state of New York, all the top criminal defense lawyers, both public defenders and private attorneys, in that organization. And of course, my first accomplishment legislatively was what they referred to as Rockefeller drug law reform. And that was sort of my initiation into legislative matters. Since then, there's been many other issues that I've worked on in Albany. So I feel like I can address these issues. My understanding is the reason I was invited here is because District Attorney Cornwright previously addressed this committee on these pending state issues. I'm not sure why the county, I mean, other than informational, it's of great importance, why the county would want to be involved in these issues, since they are statewide issues. But I'm happy to provide you with what I know about them, what's happening even this week with regards to them. And I even prepared a draft resolution because on the criminal justice reforms pending in Albany, because several other counties, including Westchester County Onondaga, and I think Rochester is, that's not Monroe, what's Rochester?
It's Monroe.
It is, yeah. Clifford Ducker, he came from those parts. They passed a similar resolution. I'm sorry I don't have copies for everybody in the room.
We can get copies.
If you want. But that's if you decide to run with that. So let me begin by saying we've all heard about the package, criminal justice reform. And that's referring to the big three, bail reform, discovery reform, and speedy trial reform. There's also other criminal justice issues that aren't considered part of that package, but they're also up for discussion right now, and that's solitary confinement, which certainly affects the sheriff's office. And it looks like there's going to be a change on that, because they already have in the Senate, I'll digress for just a minute on that, 32 co-sponsors of a bill. On any given day, 7% of the incarcerated population in the state of New York is in solitary confinement. And without this new law, which limits the amount of time someone could be in solitary confinement, often that's long term. By long term, we mean more than a couple of months. Sometimes it can be years in state prisons, not county jails. The legislation that's pending on solitary confinement proposes that they have to be outside their cell at least 4 hours a day. The state has to be notified if anyone is in solitary more than 1 month, or if they're under age 18. And no one can spend more than 15 days in solitary confinement, period, or 20 if it's within a two-month period. That's it. So that's solitary confinement. That looks like it's going to become law. The governor has a slightly different variation than the Senate bill. The other criminal justice reform that's not part of the big three is parole reform, because there's a lot of procedural matters in parole, without going into that, don't adhere strictly to the current laws. So they want to beef up the enforcement of true parole hearings and give people true due process and in parole hearings, which do take place, by the way, at the Ulster County Jail. And we have, for those of you who don't know, we have an assistant public defender who does nothing, a part-time attorney who does nothing but parole hearings for the county on behalf of the parolees who are accused of violating the terms and conditions of their parole. So let's start with now criminal justice package. Bail reform. It has, you know, it's almost common sense that we have a two-tiered system that disparately affects brown and black people and poor people in our current bail system. By that I mean, if you have money, you get out on bail. If you don't have money, you stay incarcerated pre-trial. And so the legislature, and this conversation took place about 50 years ago in the New York State Legislature, and back then our bail laws were considered pretty progressive. But it turns out now that it's just common sense that it shouldn't be this two-tiered disparate system of justice for those with money and without. So that's when you hear the politicians saying, we want no cash bail going forward. And what that means is there should be, the current bills propose a presumption of release with certain exceptions, the most serious crimes, of course. And in terms of that release, there should be other alternatives used to monitor people pre-trial. For example, pre-trial probation, electronic monitoring. It requires notification. There's been a lot of studies done where most people who don't make their court dates, it's because, not because they're fleeing the jurisdiction, it's just irresponsibility. It's just, they space out. I can't tell you how many of our clients say, I just forgot. They're not going to Puerto Rico or Florida. They just were irresponsible. And generally the judges get that and will adjourn the case without issuing a bench warrant at least once. Second time they'll get a warrant if they miss a second day. But so a notification system is that no matter how poor my clients happen to be, it seems they always have a smartphone. And so we have in place now the ability to notify them the day before. Like the way we get reminders of doctor's appointments and dentist appointments and things of that nature, we do that. Don't forget, you have court tomorrow morning before Judge Williams at 9 o'clock. Be there. And that goes to their smart. The studies have shown that that makes a huge difference in getting people to make their court appearances. Now, I'm aware that the district attorneys are very concerned about the no cash bail because they feel that bad guys will be out to commit more crimes, possibly, under this system. That is anecdotal. You know, we haven't seen that. And again, if you think, look, a vast majority of cases that are arraigned in the town courts, people are released on their own recognizance anyway. With misdemeanors, it's you know, my position, it's the Senate's position, we should just release people on all misdemeanors. The district attorneys would say, well, what about domestic violence cases? What about... And the district attorneys have a point where they say, if I've got a guy who on the way into the police car said, the moment I get out, I'm coming back here to kill you, you know, even if it's only a misdemeanor, the district attorney is, what am I supposed to do with that guy? ROR him? You know, let him go home? And that's a legitimate concern. But there's electronic monitoring, like I said earlier. There's pretrial services, supervision. And so I don't think, again, this is all anecdotal, but I don't think, you know, in a case where that is a serious threat to a specific individual, that's the governor's language right now in the bill. They provide for that. And it says, you know, if there's a specific threat to a specific individual, that's okay for the judge to consider and whether to remand or not. He still wants no cash bail. Mm-hmm. So the defense community is a little concerned that be careful what we wish for. Because if we say no cash bail, but you get remanded in certain cases at the discretion of the judge or in certain defined crimes, let's say a nonviolent crime like drug sale, that gets remanded, shouldn't that person, a few of those people might be able to make bail. And so the defense community is like, wait, we don't want all no cash bail. Maybe we want cash bail in certain buckets, certain defined cases. So that's the debate that's going on right now with the two men and the woman in the room. And I understand there's now even a committee. There's even a committee of some other legislators on criminal justice reform, both in the Senate and the Assembly, and they're powwowing like crazy right now. And I'm actually invited to one of those meetings tomorrow to talk about all these issues, because they're trying to get a compromise in time to get it done with the budget by April 1st. So that's a summary, I think, of bail. I'll answer questions about bail and discovery and speedy trial. My pet issue is discovery reform. Of course, as a practicing attorney in New York State for 40 years or so, I know that we are blindfolded. You know, we have a coalition of 20 organizations and about 100 more have signed on to our position, and it's called the Blindfold, Repeal the Blindfold Law Coalition, because we don't get enough information to adequately inform our clients whether to take a plea or not, whether to go to trial or not. And in civil cases in New York, you get plenty of discovery. When money is at stake, you get to examine or depose witnesses, parties, so on and so forth before trial. You get all an abundance of information in preparation, and then it helps cases resolve earlier in many cases. In New York, it's our position that if we get this information earlier, if Cliff gives me the video of my guy selling cocaine, I don't go into trial mode. I go into, let me get him the best plea bargain I can get. That's my... In a domestic violence case, same thing. If I see the information that my client is going likely to be convicted, I'm now trying to get the best plea bargain I can. But in discovery, the domestic violence cases and, I guess, sexual assault cases are the third rail for the district attorneys. Now, DV can, and what I mean by that is, ordinarily, part of what we would get in the new discovery laws is the names of all the witnesses and contact them. And this has been the District Attorneys Association of the State of New York mantra for 10 years. I've been dealing with this. And they've gotten a lot of mileage out of it in the past. But since the Senate is now blue, this year they're having a more difficult time. And the reason is because it's pretty much intellectually bankrupt as an argument against discovery reform. And I can tell you why. DV cases, by definition, the parties know each other. That's what defines a domestic violence case. In the law, they have to be living together, married, family, know each other. So that, to say we don't want to give up the name of the victim in a domestic violence case, makes no sense right there. Now, if you're talking about strangers, like a true rape, you know, case, vestibule type case where somebody is going, I understand. And in those cases, every discovery reform law that has been introduced in the legislature for the last 10 years, similar to this here, has a provision where the district attorneys can protect, withhold that information. And that's called a protective order. And there's no judge that I know in the world that would err on the side of exposing a victim to a problem. Cliff knows that if he goes to any judge and says, I need a protective order because these parties don't know each other, the judge is going to grant it summarily. I could talk and argue again, but I would never do that. I serve on the Chief Judge's Task Force on Wrongful Convictions, one of the other hats I wear. And that's got Court of Appeals judges on every district attorneys from all over the state. And we had district attorneys invited to come speak to us at that task force many times from other states. And I remember something that resonated with me by the Suffolk County, Boston, Massachusetts district attorney. He just retired in December. But he had been DA in Boston for about 10 years, and he said, in my 10 years as DA, we have had to get a protective order twice. He goes, because we call up the defense attorney, Kossover, I can't give you, look, your guy's in a gang, or he's a bad guy, this is his second rape charge, he doesn't know this victim, I can't, I'm like, take it out, redact it. That's what we call redaction. So short of a protective order, I'm going to use Cliff because he's in the room. For you who don't know, he's one of the senior district attorneys in Mr. Conright's office. Cliff calls me up and says, Kossover, your guy's a blood, blah, blah, blah. I go, stop, redact. Conversation's over. We get along. In Boston, a much bigger place than Ulster County, Kingston, the DA says, we do that all the time with defense attorneys. We can agree to protect people. I don't want to see a victim or a witness get hurt. That's not the job of a defense attorney. That's not how we want to win cases. I actually had to explain that to Cy Vance at one of the meetings because he looked at me and he says, you want these people to get killed. I'm like, you know, so we got at it a little bit. I said, that's ridiculous. So we agree. We consent. Another thing they can do that they do in federal court all the time, and that's for attorney's eyes only. And we can stipulate to that. In other words, the district attorney can provide me this strictly confidential information, say, Andy, it's for your eyes only, not your client, not for the bad guy that we think is the bad guy that could intimidate or possibly harm our witness or our victim. And we abide by that. And that can be reduced to writing. In federal court, it's actually a form of a protective order that everybody signs off on, including the public defender's investigator, because sometimes they have to invest. So only for the attorneys and the investigator's eyes, nobody else. So there's redaction, there's for attorney's eyes only, which is practiced in every state in the union, in federal court, and ultimately, if we can't agree, they get a protective order. 48 other states have the same kind of discovery law that we're proposing in New York now. We're very late to this game. I have spoken to Texas prosecutors, Texas judges. In your packet that I handed out, you don't have it, Ken, I'll get you one. There's a New York Times editorial entitled entitled How to Make New York's Law as Progressive as Discovery Law as Progressive as Texas, because that's how embarrassing it is at this point. I want you to know I'm proud of that editorial, because that was a result of me meeting with the New York Times editorial board and a couple of other people from our coalition, and then they published that about a week later. The bottom line is that's why those arguments, really, by the District Attorneys Association don't hold water. The reason they make those arguments is somewhat human nature. You know, I know many district attorneys in the state that practice what we call open discovery, which is what we have, you get as soon as we get it. If they have to say, I got to think about that request, Mr. Kossover, that's not open discovery. They give it. But the District Attorneys Association, that entity likes the advantage they have by them being the gatekeepers of what disclosure, what information we get. It gives them a significant advantage. One of the things that resonated with Governor Cuomo when I spoke to him about this was it is not uncommon on the eve of trial for the Ulster County District Attorney to give us maybe 24 hours before we pick a jury what's called Rosario material. And that's a courtesy, because they technically don't have to give it to us before trial, but they give it to us. And I have gotten above 4,000 pages of documentation of that Rosario. Now, how is a defense attorney supposed to, in 24 hours, meaningfully review that material and perhaps investigate it? Some of it might call for further investigation. So we're put in a position where we're going to my county court judge saying, I just got all these materials, judge. I need more time. I can't go to trial now. Judge says, I've got 100 people coming in tomorrow for jury selection. I'm not adjourning this trial, Mr. Kossover. Do the best you can. If there's something that you convince me you need an extra day or two to do, perhaps I'll do that. So we spend a lot of time without discovery reform arguing over discovery, what we should get, what we shouldn't. And earlier discovery, like I mentioned earlier, is earlier closure of cases. Quicker, please. And if you're thinking about the victims, that's earlier closure for victims also. They get to have the case over. I can't imagine how horrific it must be for a sexual assault victim to have to talk to a bunch of strangers in law enforcement, as well trained as they are in that family, what's it called? The
Child
Advocacy. I mean, they got, you know, great. But imagine having to talk to all these strangers, have a medical examination, then talk to district attorney, then maybe have to testify in a grand jury, and you haven't even been cross-examined by a defense attorney yet. If you can give that victim closure earlier through better, more early and meaningful discovery, you know, if I had somebody, you know, I've got three daughters, if I had one of them in that situation, I'd love for them to be able to have the case resolved without them going to the grand jury. Give us what you have. If you got our guy, let's talk plea, not trial, not grand jury. So there's a lot of advantages, as far as I'm concerned, to these criminal justice reforms. I'll move on to speedy trial. That one's pretty simple. There's not too much controversy on that. Speedy trial right now is based essentially on the people, meaning the district attorney, telling the court, we are ready for trial. And that stops the clock from running. Because everybody under New York law is entitled to a speedy trial, essentially within 6 months on a felony and 3 months, 90 days on a misdemeanor. But that clock doesn't run once the people answer ready for trial. And so what the speedy trial reform wants to do is eliminate the readiness issue. It wants to just say, you get your trial regardless of what the district attorney's position is within a set amount of time. And so we don't have to play, again, a lot of time and effort in the court, in the motion practice, is devoted to, were the people really ready, or they just answered ready? You know, they didn't have all their lab reports, or they didn't have their witness, or, you know. So we spend a lot of time arguing whether their readiness was
illusory
or bona fide or not. So that's what, you know, so this eliminates all those arguments. And the discovery reform package, just to go back one step, is also automatic. It means we don't have to make motions. I don't have to find out whether there was a second drug test done of a witness. It automatically comes to us. So it saves all the motion practice. It saves Forrest. And the district attorney, in some way, when you speak to district attorneys from other states that fought against discovery reform and now live with it and recommend it, it's because, you know what? I got relieved of my gatekeeping responsibilities. That was a heavy ethical thing for me to deal with. Now, I just hand it over. I don't have to worry about it. So, you know, almost, I'd say, this is anecdotal also, but 90% of former prosecutors I speak to favor discovery reform. We just filed a letter with over 100 former prosecutors in the state of New York recommending that this bill, introduced by Assembly Member Lentil in the Assembly and Deputy Majority Leader Jamal Bailey from the Bronx, he introduced it in the Senate. So they're like bills, all these discovery bills. And we've got almost all the needed sponsors for that, but we could use a few more. But I think we have the votes anyway. So that's what's going on right now. I'm going to shut up for a little bit and take any questions.
I think Ken wanted to join.
Yeah, I've got a question for you, Andy. You know, when Holly was here talking about some of his concerns about some of the criminal justice reforms, the specific one that he raised to the committee, and I think one of them that brought us all here tonight, is the fact that the discovery reform bill, as it's written, would essentially have stopped him from being able to prosecute a vehicular homicide case that he's in the middle of that he's waiting to prosecute, because he's waiting for a piece of evidence to come from the state crime lab and wouldn't have it to give to you in time to be able to comply with the Discovery Reform Act and the Speedy Trial Act. And, you know, sort of get your opinion on that, you know, based on the length of time that it can take to get reports from, you know, an organization like the State Crime Lab, the State Police Crime Lab, because
perfectly
they need accident.
Good question. Really bad argument by Mr. Conrad, but perfectly good question. The statute provides for it.
Okay.
It provides for it. I'm looking at it. 245.05, because the current law is 240, Article 240 of the crime. So that this replaces that. This is now going to be 240. The very first section says, if the district attorney doesn't have a lab report, because we know this, or anything, or things are so voluminous that he needs more time, the district attorney, he or she, because depending on the county, gets that more time. And they have language like, as soon as practical.
Mm-hmm.
So that's already contemplated by the new statute.
So what's the 15 days?
Don't forget that it says 15 days or less, not practical. And they get an automatic extension without a motion. The district attorney can take more time without motion practice. It's right in the statute. Part of the problem I encounter in doing my legislative work on this is very few district attorneys have actually read the statute, and very few legislators have actually read the statute. It's online. Anybody can read it. But people, they get talking points from the District Attorneys Association, the state of New York. Many district attorneys can have come out in favor of this. Mm-hmm. Eric Gonzalez, Bronx DA, it'll come
up. Upstate, yeah.
Okay. but your Onondaga County guy came out all in favor of this statute because they're the ones that say, I'm okay with it. They've read it. You know, it's really interesting to see when you can tell when the DA has read the statute because all their arguments. So the rest of them are getting constant memos from the District Attorneys Association. Write a letter to the editor. Here's your talking points. And they just go with it. But people who take the time, to dig in, like you do, Ken, like mm-hmm. Tracy does, don't take me. Don't take my word. I'm looking at it. I expected that question. I highlighted the language about, right here, that mm-hmm. they get additional time for any problems like that. This is the source. This is what's being voted on in Albany. So he would be able to prosecute that case, is my point, that vehicular manslaughter. So that's my answer to that.
Cliff Bowens from the DA's office. I'd like to bring up just a couple of your points. I'll start with bail and then go to discovery. Bail.
Go ahead. You're good. Go
sorry.
Ahead. No, you're recognized. Go ahead. They're making fun of me, not you.
They?
No. The joke was on me.
No, let's face it, Andy. Bail is for really one reason, technically. And that's what?
You're going to say dangerousness? Or getting him back to court?
Getting back to court.
Okay, that's the real reason.
Now, I mean, and it'd be disingenuous for Andy, myself, or any judge to say we don't consider the heinousness or the dangerous crime that is being committed because we don't want a dead body or someone injured on our watch. So we're arguing risk of flight being it's a be violent or whatever, but really we're trying to use that argument to keep someone in from hurting someone else. I mean, really, that's the reality. Would you agree with that?
Well, that's the elephant in the room.
You're not allowed to do that, are you?
Right. Well, let me explain. 50 years ago, I mentioned Cliff's right, the New York State Legislature discussed dangerousness. As much as we are a minority in discovery reform, we're also a minority in bail. Most of the other states consider what we call we abbreviated dangerousness, but community safety, whatever judges can consider that when they set bail.
Like a risk assessment?
Right, and that's part of what the new law wants to do is have risk assessment tools. That brings up a whole nother argument and how that could be discriminatory against people of color. But the fact remains that New York, 50 years ago, decided because of the presumption of innocence, we can't put into our laws that the judges should consider dangerousness or they're going to commit another violent crime because they're presumed innocent. We're not going to go there. That's why it was considered so progressive. To add it now, which the District Attorneys Association would like, would be a step backwards in my opinion, because I enjoy the fact that it's not in the statute. But as Cliff is intimating, every judge thinks about it. You know, in New York City, they say, the New York Post regulates bail decisions more than the criminal procedure law. Judges care about what the New York Post is going to say the next day. So here, judges, well-meaning judges, say, I'm not sending that guy home, when he just threatened to kill his spouse on the way out the door, even though he's not supposed to consider that under current law.
Well, common sense and human nature dictate.
Right. Yeah, it's the elephant in the room, so to speak. So that, and I've spoken to the sheriff. There's other examples, less dramatic. Our town judges arraign guys in the middle of the night. They're above a 2-0, very high BAC on a DWI. Guy's 40 years old. no prior record, employed, owns a house. Of course that guy should ordinarily be released without bail, but the judge doesn't want to see him walk into the street and get hit by the first truck that comes down the street. So he goes, I'm sending him up to the Ulster County Jail on, how much money you got on you, Mr. Smith? $200. I'm sending him up to the jail on $250 bail because I want him to sober up. I don't want him getting hurt on his way home. Or getting
same
back
to somebody else.
Is an opiate addict that
right.
ODs
right.
and Narcan of three
exactly
times.
The same thing.
Up, he's, you know, stole something. The judge sends him home. He's shooting up and within a half an
he
hour.
He could die.
But
exactly.
That's the reality of it.
That's
bail.
Those are the realities. But
Sheriff, yeah,
yeah. Just to add on to the comment, I don't think anybody's saying that if you're rich or poor, that you should be in jail for committing a crime. You know, bail is for that purpose, is to make sure you come back to court. I think what we're saying, and everybody's hit on it, is that most of these judges and most law enforcement, even most of the prosecutors and defenders, they know the people in the county. So when someone comes to court, the judge knows this guy's going to be probable or not because he's been there several times. So whether he's innocent or not, it's the difference when there's one person that did one thing and then another person that did several things in the same court. They know these individuals. And this bail reform kind of takes that away from the local judges, from law enforcement, from the DA's office, that type of purview of what, and there is a danger to it when it comes to violence and domestic violence and harassment and crimes of passion and felonies. And these are the concerns that law enforcement has, because no one in this room has to deal with going to the same house 10 times at night except those that are in uniform. So we have a different perspective on it. And but yes, bail reform is definitely needed. I mean, there's no question about that. But smart bail reform, and we really have to think about the victims, because no one really is talking about them in length. And the victims are the ones that are going to suffer, or weak, or underprivileged, or women. They're the ones that are going to suffer. And even if it's a misdemeanor, and there's no bail, and the judge isn't going to be able to release them or hold them because there's no bail, he's going to be out there, or she's going to be out there committing these. She's going to go back. And we're going to be going back 6, 7, 8, 9 times a night until something's done. That's the concern.
Can I ask a question? Do you have stats on how many criminal contempt seconds turn into criminal contempt serves?
Criminal contempt seconds are charged?
That turn into criminal contempt first eventually.
I
like violating all
no, I understand what the question is.
We book so many people on criminal contempt
right.
in jail.
But are those people on EM? Electronic monitor.
I have no idea.
Okay.
No
so, everything we're saying, I don't think there's that much daylight between
sir,
our positions.
My point is, if I go to get arraigned tonight on a criminal contempt second,
mm-hmm.
because I just got into an argument with my girlfriend that I shouldn't have
right,
been
for violating
close to,
order of protection.
For violating it, and I'm to misdemeanor, it's a criminal tech second to a misdemeanor,
right.
so I get released that night.
Mm-hmm.
There's nothing, I'm not getting a ankle monitor put on me that night at 3 o'clock in the morning.
Right.
So what's stopping me from going back to that same house at 3 o'clock in the morning?
What's
There's nothing stopping me.
And
well,
he understands. I mean,
I get that, but my, I think the point is, in a case like that, and that is one of the buckets that's carved out in one of the bail proposals right now. That's the specific, you know, threat to a specific individual. So the district attorney has to go into court and say, he's already violated your order of protection. This is a remand case, Your Honor. Or, if we end up with cash bail, then I can't bail. But even then, if that guy can make the cash bail, he still goes back and commits a criminal contempt first, perhaps. We don't know. But I think the best thing in a case like that is you put him in overnight until you get an electronic ankle bracelet on him the next morning. And, you know, yeah, well, you're going
to
have, look, that's
going
to
be expensive. Go
well,
on.
No, it is expensive. But it also goes back to your, it also goes back to your question, Ken, about DA Conright, which is, you know, a lot of this stuff costs money, pretrial services, electronic monitoring, and, you know, a lot of district attorneys, like in New York City, I mean, up here, we deal with a certain volume. I've heard from Cy Vance, the New York County District Attorney. I've heard from, you know, how are we supposed to make copy? You realize how many, we have 24-hour arraignment parts, you know, with hundreds of people coming through. How can we make, we can't physically make the copies. That's a feeble argument when you're talking about people's liberty and stuff. So I'm saying, you know, if the state police lab, and the statute does provide for awaiting expert reports and stuff like that, but even if it, then that means the state police lab needs to get stuff out quicker, needs to move faster. That's money. And the governor is well aware that criminal justice reform is going to take
If I could just comment on that, I'm sure the governor is aware that it's going to cost lots and lots of money, mm-hmm. and he has absolutely, absolutely, positively no intention of paying for it himself, because he has all these counties around the state that have their own budgets, mm-hmm. and he's going to make us raise taxes. He's going to make us cut services in order to be able to pay for them.
Well, that's
the same way when they gave us. Raised the age,
right.
and then pushed all this further responsibility onto probation and onto the county attorney's office, out of the DA's office, and out of the sheriff's department. They gave us very little to work with on paying for it, so we're doing that out of our own coffers.
And he also wants to do a 2% cap, so I get it.
With no mandate.
Can I just please? And then Tracy, did you have a question? Okay, so we'll let Director Smith, and then you can get your question.
So in terms of electronic monitoring, right now we ask the courts that we need a week to even get equipment. We don't have the ability to instantly put people on electronic monitoring. But keep in mind, it's not foolproof. It's a form of technology that has problems, and there's a lot of technical difficulties in a county like this. There mm-hmm. are areas where it doesn't work. People don't have phones anymore. We used to use phone lines. People don't have phones. They're using cell phones as their home phone lines.
Mm-hmm.
So we, in some cases, have to use cellular technology, which doesn't work in our mountainous areas. If we use GPS, there's mm-hmm. problems with GPS. So it's not a foolproof method. It is, for us, resource intensive for staffing. We have 24 staff on call, but it also requires a lot in order just to do a hookup for someone. So there is not, here anyway, we don't have dedicated staff that just, like in some counties, their volume is so high, they have dedicated staff that sit around and wait for someone to get put on EM. We don't have that. We have 15, 16 people on at any given time on electronic monitoring. So I just wanted to mention that it is not foolproof.
Yeah,
Tracy, did you want to?
Yeah, my question was just how this proposal is different from what exists in Washington, D.C., because isn't that a model of cashless bail that's been in operation for a long time now?
Right. California, I think D.C., New Jersey.
New Jersey. New Jersey is more recent.
Colorado. And California made some mistakes with it. And New York is aware of that. So they revised the statute so they don't make the same mistakes. But nothing is foolproof. Nothing we can do. I mean, we all know if someone's out to commit a homicide and they're intent on it, no matter what we do, you're going to have 100 orders of protection and electronic monitoring. And, the only thing is remand for that person, And then, who knows, even when they get out a year later, crazy stuff happens, I've had clients make excuses. I'll show you where the body is on an unrelated homicide just to get out long enough to run away, commit a homicide, and go back in. I mean, these guys know, they don't call them cons for nothing, So there's stuff that goes on. We know that, but... but again, you also don't want the one incident or the one terrible incident to wag the dog. It's like you're trying to do most justice, true justice for as many people as possible. And of course, there's always going to be someone's worst nightmare. That despite everything we do by well-intentioned people, someone might get hurt one day. All of Texas is swearing by their due discovery laws. It's been about 10 years for them, and thank God they haven't had any witnesses or victims hurt. Eric Gonzalez, the district attorney in Kings County, Brooklyn, said, We don't lose because we have open file discovery. I don't see my district attorneys losing any more cases, you know, and we haven't had any victims or witnesses hurt. So, and that's Brooklyn, where there's a whole lot of gang activity. I think if that happened, I'm not sure it would change Mr. Gonzalez's position. He'd say that's a terrible, unfortunate thing, but that doesn't mean for all the other people that need to have an informed decision what to do with a life decision, whether to take a plea bargain or not, or go to trial or not, those people still deserve, you know, the progressive discovery laws that are being proposed right now. Not
sure.
I just wanted to add one last thing about bail reform. Is what's going to happen initially once this does happen is warrants. We're going to get a lot of warrants. We don't have warrant squads, only the state police. So we're going to have to develop warrant squads to go track people down.
I don't
Granted,
think
it's a lot easier to track people down today than it was before, but that's still, that's going to be a concern. And in reference to New York City, working there for 19 years, there are two boroughs that have the worst prosecution rate in the city, and that's the Bronx and Brooklyn. So
that's just because of the jurors.
Right.
That's not that has nothing to do, you know, no, it's true. That has nothing to do with the criminal justice system.
Bad.
You know, it's the jury pools in the Brooklyn and the Bronx are very, let's just say,
anti-cop.
Yeah, anti-cop. They're
there's a really fun proposal that's coming forward now that I was up in Albany today and the Assembly Republican Conference briefed on it, allowing felons to serve on juries. I'm sure that's going to make the conviction rate go down as well. I call it the Hung Jury Act. But
yeah, I mean, I was curious because when Cartwright was here, one of the things that he said that some of these reforms were actually anti-victim, right? And our feeling was that if we had an opportunity to weigh in and call our representatives or to write a committee letter in order to say, look, can you take a closer look at this? There might be elements of the reform we want to keep and elements we want to change. That was sort of the impetus of all of this. But I think one of the things that Ken brought up, and I just wanted to bring this up and then I'll turn to you, was that I guess one of the things that I'm kind of concerned about, like for example, we're talking about the dangerous component and weighing bail and what to do with someone, right? And these guys are here saying, you know, we want the judges, the local judges, to have discretion. They know these guys, and they can weigh in and decide, no, this guy's got to stay. He's really dangerous. This guy's not. And you're saying, well, that happens informally anyway on the part of judge. Does it need to be formalized as part of the process? Is it enough?
Well, is it
enough to say, well, it's human nature. We all do this. Or does it need to be formalized? And I'm hearing Cartwright say this is anti-victim. In the case that he was talking about, and with some of these reforms, he was talking about how if he it's not the extension that you're talking about, the 15-day extension, if there is a backup at the state lab, for example. He was talking
There's
about...
There's more than a 15-day in it, but go ahead. Yeah.
Is that a fail-safe, I guess is what I want to ask you. Just as you go before a judge and you say, wait, I just got 24 hours before the trial, 4,000 pages, it's not, you know, this isn't fair. This right. is a violation of due process, and I got to go through this. And he says, no, you got it maybe a day here or there. Is there any guarantee that that won't happen in this instance where, you know, the DA says, you know, I've been waiting for this report to come out. The lab at the state level is backed up. And I need more time. And the judge says, and then he was linking missing the deadline with the case actually being dismissed because it's linked to the demand for a speedy trial. So I just want to, those are instances that don't seem to me, especially in light of the way that Cartwright characterized some of these reforms being anti-victim, I'm not sure that it gives me the reassurance that there are enough protections to make sure on both sides, right? Not just on the public defender side, but on the prosecution side, that there's a fair opportunity to have a trial dedicated to due process. Mm-hmm. So you can respond to that, not respond to that. Well, or we can go over here, and then you can respond later. Whatever you want to do.
It's okay, Cliff. I don't know who wants.
Yeah, go ahead, Cliff.
Thank you, and I agree with what you're saying. That we're concerned about the victims and the victims' families, the safety of our community. Not so much the defendants. Our job as the DA is to do justice. So that means to be fair to the defendant, but also to protect the community and be fair to our victims. To bail, let's just talk a little bit. I want to touch on that again without using a passionate example. You're a business owner and you own Getty's Food Mart or whatever, and this person has 50 petty larcenies on his record because he steals all the time to feed a habit or whatever. He's arrested. The owner of Getty's says, you know, he swears out a deposition. This guy stole again from me, you know, $58 worth of stuff. You know, and he's done it like three times in the past. He goes in front of this judge with his bail reform. Boom, you're out. And the owner, business owner from Kingston, he's walking by my place giving me the finger now. I mean, doesn't it just undermine the community's faith in the criminal justice system if you take away the discretion of a judge to set bail in situations where the rap sheet's this long, even though they are all 100 petty larcenies? I mean, so that's a point I'd like to make. Secondly, the discovery victims. If you're a victim of a rape, a robbery, where a gun is stuck in your face, or you're an older woman that was just burglarized, where she sees a person standing in her bedroom, and with this new discovery rule, you're going to get to sit across from her and depose her, and cross-examine her after she's been traumatically violated. Well, no, I'm saying you were talking about you.
That's not in the law. We're talking about.
You had said that, like in the civil practice, you're allowed to depose people,
right?
For the civil. I understand that. But as my understanding, that was somewhat part of the new law that they would allow
law enforcement
to depose victims.
No.
If that's not true, I thought I was sitting in the sheriff's office one day and we saw a sheriff that proposed legislation with the undersheriff. So
no, that's not in the law. So the second part, there are jurisdictions, Florida, you can depose everyone in a criminal case, just like in New York, a civil case. They don't have a problem with it. I know lawyers who work for me now, who practiced in the state of Florida, said it was unbelievable. And the district attorneys got to see how their witnesses did, and they helped them evaluate their case also. But I think what we're all dancing around now is something that, when I've debated Holly at Bar Association events in the past, it all comes down to. There's a law enforcement perspective, and there's a defense perspective, like a community perspective. We all have our... Holly, like, raised the age and everything. He hated all that. Anything that takes discretion away from his office, he's against. You know, I'm not allowed to question an 18-year-old now, a 17-year-old, without mommy and daddy being present. I might not be able to solve certain crimes. I get it. That's a law enforcement perspective. I understand. But the parents of that age, that's another perspective. I don't want trained interrogators talking to my kid without me knowing it. You know? So I get up after Holly speaks and I go, that's true of that perspective. He's all about making a case. These guys are about making a case and closing it out. And if appropriate, as Cliff touched on, which, you know, justice, accomplishing justice. If that means a conviction, fine. If it means an acquittal, fine. But that's a perspective. So when you say, is it a victim, anti-victim? No, they're not. This is done. All of these laws, again, because I'm heavily involved, and I know that Mr. Cronwright is not. He's limitedly involved with the district attorney's sort. But I've got the, you know, leading district attorneys on all these committees and task force that I serve on. I was chair of the State Bar Committee on Mandated Representation, which is a fancy word for public defense. And all of these proposals that we're talking about were generated originally out of State Bar and Task Force made up of prosecutors, defense attorneys, judges. So these aren't anti-victim or pro-prosecutor, make their, it isn't about do they lose an advantage, do we gain an advantage. All these reforms are about justice, true justice, making, balancing law enforcement perspective without, it isn't about making a case. It's about what's just, what's right in our country, in our system, in our state at this time. And it's percolated up over the last 10 years from all these State Bar and Justice Task Force that deliberated and had experts from all over the country come in. Nothing I could say is probably clearer or more vital than to say 48 other states have done this without a problem. That really should be the last thing I have to say. All this other stuff is because certain people, human, want to have an advantage or have that perspective. Even if it's not, they want, the district attorneys want to keep a keep an advantage of gatekeeping. Even if it's not that, it's still the law enforcement perspective. Holly cares about his evidence, making a case, getting a conviction.
Doing justice, protecting the community.
I don't see that. I'm on the opposite side. And lots of times, I've had issues with Mr. Conrad, where, you know, he wrote a letter, Cliff, to Judge Williams, saying, is this Brady material? Brady is stuff that tends to help the defense, exculpatory. And he wrote a letter about one of his witnesses having a positive drug test. And he wrote, like, 20 days before trial, he wrote this letter to Judge Williams. And of course, Judge Williams said, hand it over to Cosgrove. When I got the report, you know how long? I had the district attorney's stamp on it. Received district attorney's office 12 months before. So he waited until 20 days before.
Wait,
that's not
something. Found out, though, Andy, and I would like to say one point.
That he didn't know? It said received district attorney.
Discovery in my office, and I practice this, has been how you said. It's pretty much open file. I don't try to hide the salami.
I'm not, Cliff, I have no problem with you, Cliff. I'm not talking, we're talking individuals now. There's members of your office.
I can't speak for everyone, but I try to mentor
you. You don't have to be defensive.
Turn it over.
Can I just say, I think, like, I'm going to go to Sheriff in a second, but I think the question is really, you know, rules and procedures are never neutral. They're designed to make certain outcomes more or less likely. And so I think, you know, what's going on here is a balance of, you know, trying to make sure, and the way in which you've described the process, that there have been many perspectives about what rules should be reformed and what. And so that seems to me, but a lot rides on these rules and procedures, right? They're not just simply neutral, and I think that's really kind of what's significantly at stake as we're sort of tinkering with this stuff. I'm gonna.
So for everybody's sake, I mean, we're all here for the interest of justice. That's really what this is about. People get off on technicalities all the time. These new rules are going to bring even more technicalities, and sometimes the criminal is going to walk. Sometimes the cases are truthfully dismissed because there was insufficient evidence. And it happens on both sides of it. With that said, you know, we're an hour and a half, hour and 45 minutes north of New York City, and there's a lot of crime in New York City. We don't see it, but it's up here as well. And I have concerns about witnesses. I heard Mr. Kosover said, Andy say it, about witnesses and that, you know, if somebody would call him, that he would just say, hey, redact. Well, that's not always the case. And so, you know, we are concerned in law enforcement about witnesses. Witness intimidation is a really easy thing to do. It happens on a regular basis. It could just be a look. I mean, you can go back to the old movie, The Godfather, where he's sitting in the grand jury room and he brings the brother of the person that's being interviewed by the, as an example. So witness tampering, witness intimidation, is serious, and something like this will happen, And we can agree, like, I know he's a good person, and I know he's a good person if these folks here in Ulster County would talk and say, hey, look, this guy has an issue, and they'll know the witness, there's an issue with the witness, let's redact it. That's fine, but that's not always the case. And those people on the law enforcement side of it are the ones that we're concerned about and worry about in the prosecution of a case that put somebody who should be in prison. And those are our concerns in that sort of thing. You know, criminal reform is something that's needed. We all know that. We all agree. Sometimes the folks on the side of defending those that can't be defended, they are part of the criminal justice system. They're left out a lot, but they truly are part of the criminal justice system. And maybe if we make and have these discussions, all of us should be sitting at these tables when they make these decisions, and it feels sometimes that we're not.
I'm going to go to Heidi.
Quite honestly, with all due respect, this has been cooking in Albany for quite some time, and it's coming out now, mostly because of the turnover. I think it's been in front of the state legislature for how many years now?
Well, discovery reform?
Most of the bills, actually.
Discovery reform has been introduced every year for the last 10 years or so. And I guess criminal justice, you know, look, there was a flurry of activity up there at the beginning of the session. And criminal justice always had a difficult time the past 10 years, because the district attorneys basically were such a strong lobby with the Republican-controlled Senate. So,
as is the Trial Lawyers Association with the Democrat-controlled Assembly.
Yeah, I mean, whatever. But the fact that the Senate went blue simply means that I've been fighting those intellectually bankrupt arguments of the District Attorneys Association for those 10 years. And I went to every Republican senator I could and explained why they don't hold water. Those arguments don't hold water. But Republican senators can't go back to their home county and not have their Republican elected district attorney help them get reelected. So no matter, even though off the record, many a Republican senator would say to me, I get it. I agree with you. We need these reforms. How am I supposed to get, you know, the first job we all know in Albany is to get elected. Rule number one, get elected. Rule number two, get reelected. Right? So I have very good, look, John Bonasek is a friend of mine. I have really good Republican senator friends who said, Andy, how can I vote for this? You know, if the district attorney is going, and I go home for start my campaign, I'm not going to have the support of the number one count in my district. There's three Republican DAs in my district. They're all going to, like, kill me if I vote for this. And that's what I would hear. So it isn't just about politics. It's about, you know, now that it's blue, at least the DASNY, that's what they call the district. DASNY no longer controls the Senate.
I wanted Lynn to understand, though, that this is really happening, and you know, we're a little bit late to the party. You know, I'm glad that we showed up as a county. Nonetheless, we're really late to the party. You know, I'm not overly optimistic that this is. I don't really believe that this should be part of the budget. I think it's. I don't think
either
it's gonna,
does the assembly or the, yeah, or the Senate.
I don't think it's going to be. I don't think it's going to be included in the budget. But I do think that most of this, if not the whole thing, will go through this session. But actually, my actual question though is, if someone is picked up on a domestic violence incident within a township and they're brought in front of a town justice, and so they're released under this new bail reform.
Mm-hmm.
Is there really enough time to do background on these individuals? Like, do you know?
Well, you get their criminal history as soon as they're arrested.
Do you, though? Do you really know that you have a parolee?
No, you don't know. You don't know if you have out-of-state convictions. You know, I had a guy picked up, and he has a rap sheet a mile long in Pennsylvania, but those are very cryptic, and it takes a while to get the background.
Yeah, because I just wonder if, I mean, and there's always going to be gaps in You know, no offense to anyone here, but I've seen it even on a county level where sometimes communications, there's a hole sometimes. And I just can't imagine a turnaround that quick, and then they're just right back out, potentially to re-victimize. So that, you know, that is a concern of mine, because I'll always
be... What do you do? You're proposing holding people until they check out every single state's registry?
No, but even anything that would be occurring within this county is is of concern for me also. It just, I wouldn't want to be quick to release someone so quickly without being sure you fully understand their background.
The law requires that.
Yeah, is it that quick on a database?
Well, as soon as they're fingerprinted, they get at least their New York and FBI history. That's the database these gentlemen get. And the law requires them, when they bring a body before the judge, whether it's 3 in the morning or during
the morning, that before.
They have to bring a copy of that for the judge and the prosecutor and defense attorney. They have to bring really 3 copies of the criminal history. Cliff is correct. Like anything else, it's not always perfect. We might, you know, but if someone's a serial killer wanted in California, they usually know that before they bring it in front of the New Paul's Town judge. You know, they'll know before they walk that body in. You know, I guess, again, it's like we talk about everything being foolproof. There can always be an exception. But you don't want the tail to wag the dog.
So go ahead, Ken.
Thanks. Just to respond to the, I think that the DA's Association may take a little bit of exception to be calling in, to being called intellectually bankrupt, but they might respond with, and the Assembly's been listening to the morally bankrupt Trial Lawyers Association. But
that's civil. Be that as trial lawyers.
I'm just saying, you know, and there's defense lawyers associations and everybody else. I mean, that's. You know, there's different perspectives. You know, there's a victim's perspective, and then there's a, you know, defendant's perspective. And one of the problems I think that we face here is that I would say that most likely the District Attorney's Association, the Sheriff's Association, would probably agree with 70% of what is going on in discovery reform.
I think you're right.
But the problem is that other 30%.
More than 70%.
Well, but regardless, but the problem is that, you know, instead of everybody getting down at the same table and saying, you know, this makes sense, this is how we can protect the defendant's rights and protect the victim's rights, the pendulum swings widely, and we're over here right now in your opinion, but the problem is that when all these reforms are enacted, we're going to end up over here. And, you know, maybe the system is tilted too far to the law enforcement side now. Maybe. I'm not going to say it is or it isn't, but maybe it is. At what point is it too far back over to the side of the defendants and you're sort of forgetting about the victims, not saying that it's anti-victim, because I think that that's not necessarily the right way to put it. I wouldn't say it's anti-victim, but I would say that the victims aren't in the process, aren't being contemplated in the process, especially when it comes to bail reform. A lot of the discovery reform and speedy trial reform, I can get on board with most of it. I have a real problem with bail reform because I really think that to the letter of the law, you know, but unfortunately a lot of the times when you do something to the letter of the law, it ignores common sense. And unfortunately, the law can't contemplate common sense, which is one of the problems that we run into a lot. But you know, it really it can endanger the community, because there are nonviolent crimes where, you know, let's say a guy gets his third DWI in a week, he's gonna, under the bail reform, he's guaranteed to not be held on bail. Correct.
Correct.
I mean, you know, if someone's gonna get 3 DWIs in a week, it's going to get a fourth. So at what point
unless
are we going to...
Unless you make him blow into a remote breathalyzer every half hour or hour, and the minute it's positive...
The car shuts off. Leander's law.
Picked up.
Ignition interlock device.
Yeah. But you also now... That ignition interlock device, that technology is already antiquated. They can put stuff on your smartphone. They can put stuff in your pocket. And if you don't blow...
That's required to be monitored by the probation office. And
right. But I'm just saying...
I mean, because again...
There is technology available, Ken, to prevent that example from happening. There's lots of alternatives.
As long as they use that car, as long as they...
We're not asking for... Don't forget, all the stuff you're talking about, victims groups have been at the table. The Justice Task Force on wrongful conviction.
Because they're just because they're at the table doesn't mean that their concerns have been allayed.
I'm telling you that in all the committees I have served on, and it would be like putting a group like this together, not so heavy law enforcement. but there's three district attorneys, there's three law enforcement, there's victims' rights, there's DV groups. This has been going on for 10 years. That's how we got to this moment. And because of some politics, it was never passed before for reasons I sort of went into a little bit. I went into that.
Editorialized on.
Yeah, exactly. But now, none of this is like you say, is swinging all the way from the right to the left or whatever you want to say, conservative to very liberal law. It isn't that. I think we're swinging somewhere into the middle with these as written. And even now, as we speak, and tomorrow, I'm going to be in Albany tomorrow for stuff. It's still being tweaked to make sure it's somewhere in the middle. You know, I'm sure that, you know, I've said this off the record to many senators. If they want 45 days on DV cases, if that makes them happy instead of 15 days, give it to them. So few cases, you know, we all get upset about the DV case. It's such a small percentage of case. Cliff and I know, we deal with drugs, burglaries, you know, and those are actually easy cases for the system. A little, you know, if an older, you know, if a senior citizen is, you know, tied up in their home and robbed and burglarized, you know, pistol whipped, we all know what's happening to that guy, right? Those are terrible, terrible cases. So we deal with those kinds of violent crimes and all that. When you get down to the cases where the people really don't know each other, I mean, it's such a small amount of our cases. Most of the times, there aren't even civilian witnesses. Most of the cases we handle are just law enforcement against the defendant, period. Sometimes it's a CI. That's it. That's 95% of our cases. So, you know, again, I don't want to overuse the metaphor, but you don't want the tail to wag the dog. There's a few, and on those cases, in a community like this, again, Cliff calls me up, Heidi, and says, I don't want to, you know, she's in a shelter. I've never asked in 40 years, what shelter is she in? You know, like that would be crazy. I don't need that information.
I guess the concern, though, is that when you're writing and making these sorts of reforms, it's not about you guys.
Right. It's about what can happen.
You guys are
so
reasonable.
So then he gets the protective order.
But you guys, you might leave, and we might get somebody who's not reasonable.
Right.
We might leave.
Who doesn't want to redact. Who won't agree to redact.
Right. So then he gets to the judge. Oh, that's why it's in the statute.
Yeah, I need a protective order. I understand why these reforms are coming in place is because of what happened to a lot of people that...
There's a lot of wrongful convictions.
Well, that's what I want to try and ask on the other side to change my perspective a little bit. But I'll let Director Schmidt.
I wanted to say a couple of things. One is we have a crime victims assistance program in this county, and that's part of our department. And I just wanted to commend everybody for thinking about the victims, and it makes me really proud to hear everyone.
Even me.
Yes, even you, Andy, that everyone is talking about it because it's important.
Right. It is important.
2 weeks from today starts Crime Victims Rights Week, and we're going to have some public things out there. I just wanted to just remind people of that. I have a question for Andy about when that person that got the third DWI and gets put on any kind of Alka-Seltzer, breathalyzer, whatever equipment that we have, we don't have access to the courts via the conditions we have now 24/7. So, and in this bail reform, if someone's on pretrial with a condition that they can't drink or whatever, is that going to change? Are they going to be able to incarcerate them, or is it just going to be brought back before the court?
Well, if a condition of release is violated, then the judge can say you violated the conditions of your release.
And
now
then
you're
what?
Remanded.
No bail, no nothing.
Nothing. You're in.
Even for low level.
Yeah.
All right. So, you know.
Is it the judge's discretion to then remand, or can the judge, could a less conservative judge or less than conservative judge bring the guy back in and say, bad boy, don't do it again?
Sure he could.
That's, yeah.
Thank you very much. Really appreciate you coming out. Go ahead. Yeah.
I disagree with everything you say.
The third DWI, the judge sets bail, the guy walks.
Not necessarily.
Yeah. Well, he sets bail and you come up with it. You go.
If you come up with it, that's...
You know, I just wanted to leave you two more things. Again, we're so... But this isn't very informative for you, I hope.
It's been fantastic. Thank you.
The other
really
thing is, we get those witnesses' names and stuff right now under the law, right before trial. Anyway, so this is only about, again, in the cases we need, it's just getting them earlier. All information earlier and so that we can prepare appropriately. That's all it is. And Chief Assistant Michael Cavanaugh told me, because I met with him recently about these subjects, and he told me that we don't have a harassment intimidation problem.
Projection hearsay.
In Ulster County. You know, it is.
Yeah, that guy left.
But that's what Mike told me. He goes, we really don't have that issue, and we don't see too much of that.
Yeah.
Even post-trial, he told me, like, almost zero.
We have a witness murdered.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Most cases are...
But that's when they knew each other. That wasn't because it was disclosed.
Right.
They were all gang members. Right? They all knew each other. That wasn't as a result of discovery or bail.
Yeah.
Is there anything in regards to mental health in that bail reform?
Yeah. All services. And that's a pretrial. So they can demand rehabs. They can demand mental health. Again, yeah.
Well, I mean, we have dozens of people. I got 730.
Oh, come on, 70% of my clients.
Why?
Well,
and that's my point. You know,
or they wouldn't be doing what they're doing.
We have tons of. What I'm saying is, those people that commit, you know, misdemeanors that have mental health problems. What are we doing with them?
Yeah.
You send them right back out in the street.
Let me just mention to that, looking at the numbers, if these numbers come to us on pretrial, Andy has two people on his staff that we work with closely who do the defender-based advocate. It's an alternatives to incarceration program. Pretrial is in that. And then Andy has somebody that works for the defense attorney working to help
other than public defenders
into the rehab or the mental health facilities. But there is a real shortage. There's a real difficulty.
Oh, yeah.
The amount of, if these numbers that the sheriff gave are all released on pretrial release, that will double our unit. We have 2.5 people doing that work. Andy's got 2 people, so we're talking double, right, to accommodate.
It sounds like a lot of the effectiveness of these reforms rides on us as a state investing in the resources, the supportive tertiary resources.
Feel free to consider the draft resolution and add to it about unfunded mandates. Say, we support these reforms as long as the counties are not held responsible for the increased expenses of pretrial alternatives and things like that. That would make sense to me.
Well, I think we're just about to wrap up. I just have one last question for you. You go ahead, Director Schmidt.
So one other thing with those folks that are in the jail that aren't getting released right now often have multiple risk factors such as mental illness, substance abuse. Mm-hmm. They've failed previously before on a release.
Right.
There's things that have happened that are why they're some of the ones that are in jail. So we also know that they aren't going to be the easiest of our cases.
Right.
So.
There's a real nexus that leads to this.
I thought when that South Carolina's, he was a state senator and his son was bipolar and he couldn't get bipolar and substance abuser. And he could, this happened a few years ago, and he came home and shot his mother, and like that guy couldn't get his kid a bed.
Right.
He was like a state senator.
Right.
I said, now the pendulum will swing. Maybe they'll start putting money towards mental health.
Right.
Mark Maliano, how do you pronounce it?
Maliano.
Told me recently, he said, you know, Andy, 10 years ago, I was on the board of visitors of the Hudson River Psych Center.
Yeah.
Mario Cuomo appointed me, yeah. Right? And he goes, in Dutchess County, I used to have 2,500 beds for mental health.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know how many I got now? He says, like, 22.
Yeah.
You know, like...
I have the same in Ulster.
You know,
well, no, not mental health. I'm sorry.
Yeah, and it's
you're
like...
being supportive. Yeah.
You know, and it's
we
like...
We don't have any support.
So yeah. I'm hoping that the pendulum swings, we get a lot more money in mental health, because that's part of the crime
it's
problem.
Underlying the crime. You know. Yeah.
I just got one last thing.
Everybody coming up.
These guys have to regular ones.
I know they have a tough job.
Yeah.
Well, Andy's defending people that don't have money, and it's so unfair. We all know that. Bail reform and criminal justice reform is needed, but it's got to be smart. And so I just want to add one last thing. I think you should all support the Ulster County Police Chief. There's an annual awards dinner. You guys should come out and meet the people.
We go every year.
Yeah, Heidi and I are there every single year.
Yep. And I think you should go.
I've been to it. I've been doing
good. It's good. So if you guys can make
let
me know. I got tickets.
Thank you. So I just.
I thought sometimes that my appearance is a bit of a chilling effect.
So about greeting this.
So Annie, I just wanted to ask. You know, I've been trying to ask from the other perspective. I want to, you know, one of the. Really sort of disheartening aspects of our legal system is the racial disparities
yes.
and the class disparities.
Yeah.
And so this might be a bit of a softball, but I want to ask you if you think these reforms do anything to deal with those racial and class disparities. Sure. Are they beneficial to that end? Because that to me would, you know, that's an enormous counterpoint to some of these other concerns.
I think that is one of the foundation blocks of all of these reforms, that, you know, the criminal justice system currently is very discriminatory against brown and black people, basically. And
you know, you haven't spoken a lot. We've seen, like, a lot on the other side, well, there's this instance.
Mm-hmm.
Right, this instance, you know, this person got away
mm-hmm.
and shouldn't have. But you haven't spoken a great deal about people that you feel, given the current structure,
mm-hmm.
that have been wrongly convicted, wrongly accused,
right.
disproportionately punished,
right.
based on implicit bias, or whatever you want to... I assume you're bringing to the table that experience as well.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, even in Kingston, even in our county court, you know, there is a different... subtle or latent racism you can feel. If I'm representing a white college girl in front of Judge Williams in county court,
mm-hmm.
and with the same charges mm-hmm. as a Latinx or Afro-American male, you know, same age, same charges, there is, you know, unfortunately, a different feeling
mm-hmm.
in the courtroom and a different disposition.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and the problem for defense attorneys is when I'm representing the white girl, I don't want to call them out because it'll hurt the white girl, right?
Right.
I've got my number one obligation, unlike district attorneys who are supposed to be about justice, right? Getting I'm about my client. I get to be like that.
Right.
So if I start saying, you know, hey, Judge Williams, or Mr. Conright, or whatever, you know, the offer on this case is a lot different than for the black, you know, teenager,
yeah.
you know, whose sister is dating a blood, you know, all of a sudden that kid is being treated a lot different. Then they'll go, okay, your girl doesn't get probation now. Now she gets to go to state prison. Like, yeah. So there's a conundrum there,
mm-hmm.
but I can tell you based on 40 years of experience in the criminal justice system, there's inherent bias, and a lot of these reforms are meant to address that.
So, in other words, so an example of how this might work, how it might help to diminish racial disparities would be, I am an African American male. I walk in. You're assessing my danger, right?
Right. Right.
Versus me as I am now walking and assessing my danger. The amount of bail that would be set
exactly.
might be might be different, and not based on even conscious bias necessarily.
That's
might
right.
Be implicit
and I don't think Holly Conroy, I'm not saying Judge Williams, anybody is a racist,
yeah.
But it is that unconscious,
right.
You know, whatever values, you know, that we talk about that we're trying to peel away now as a society, as a community, and we're having those conversations.
Yeah.
I think that's a really good thing. I mean, one of the things came
hard
out.
Thing.
Yeah,
really hard.
It's very hard.
Yeah.
but I think that but that does happen, you know, and that when a judge looks down from the bench at somebody, appearances and the color of their skin have to somehow, you know, affect that decision. You're right. You know, Lady Justice is supposed to be blindfolded.
Right,
but
right.
We're
right.
Not. But these, yeah, but you're dead on, Lynn, about that. These reforms, in large part, are supposed to address that because some of the laws are applied differently
uh-huh.
to different people and different economic and racial.
And these will, these reforms will hopefully move us toward leveling the playing field to the extent that we can.
Correct.
Right.
Correct. Yeah.
Right. I think that's probably the most powerful, compelling counterpoint to all of this. So,
that's what I started with. I thought I said that.
Right. Well, we had to rough you up a bit. Go ahead.
I don't have any more questions or necessarily discussion on these things right now. I just think that I wasn't ready to support something against them last time. I'm not ready to support something in favor of them this time. I think that we have some more diligence to do on, you know, because I understand everything that Mr. Kostover said. I understand everything that Mr. Carnwright said, and I'm sure that the whole truth is somewhere in the middle. To me and to how I feel about this, and how I feel about it's probably in the middle of the two. And it's unlikely to happen in the budget because the leaders of the Senate and Assembly have said we don't want to do this in the budget. We want to do this right in a contemplative
right.
process rather than rushed by April 1st in order to be able to pay all our bills and accomplish wide ranging policy.
The governor replied, "I've seen this movie many times before, and they're going to come around and let me put it in the budget because they and all, some of their members
we'll see.
Won't cover." I don't know what's going to happen this week. You know, it's going to be an interesting week, but we'll see.
Right.
Well, legislation that's crafted in haste is usually, or that's tweaked in haste
Look
is usually
Leander's law.
Usually it's bad legislation.
Raise the age.
It's all, but
yep.
That's the way sausage is made up there. Whatever I call it the New York Post legislation, because if you're on the front page of the New York Post, Albany passes a law 48 hours later. That's how Leander's law got passed, and it doesn't make sense, right? She knows they don't have a car, or the car doesn't work, and they still have to have an interlock device in it. There's no license plate on it.
They gotta pay for it.
But it's in their name; they own it, so they have to put an interlock.
And they gotta pay for it under the law, but they're broke, so they can't pay for it.
Right. All the fees.
So we pay for it.
Right. All the fees with a DWI for aging people, it's thousands and thousands of dollars. You know, I know if some of us are. Privileged enough to think, okay, if I had a DWI, I deserve to pay several thousand dollars. But for my clients,
I'd hope we'd say, I think I'm not going to drink and drive.
It's not even their car, it's a car with a household.
Right. So there's a lot, I agree. Haste, but that's what, we'll see what happens this week. It's an exciting time on some level, but
it's always more exciting and interesting as April 1st approaches.
Right. And then the next deadline will be June. I hope it's April 1st just so I can stop going to Walmart.
I just want to thank Mr. Kostover and Director Schmidt and all our friends in the Sheriff's Office and our good friend from the DA's office, so I had to leave early for coming. This is I enjoy conversations like this.
It was so immensely helpful. It really was, and you took time out of your evening.
And I appreciate the fact that my county representatives are interested in these issues, because you could just, go back to, canopies. I guess that's a sin.
Zoning law.
Or raise the age of cigarettes.
Yeah.
I also want to thank the members of the law enforcement committee that came over to the jail
last couple of days. I appreciate that. The chair was also there for the first time in many, 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 many years. I think you guys can come down and see how we operate.
Lynn, you might want to, I went back.
You went back for another tour?
Well, I went for Wednesday, the press release,
yeah.
and I gained so much more
information. I've been there.
Really?
Tracy told me about it, but I just kind of couldn't make it up in the middle of the day.
Yeah.
Some of us have to work.
Yeah, maybe another road trip.
That day started at 3
in the morning. It's about mass incarceration, really.
Yeah.
I think that our whole perspective is to try to understand what it is we're trying to govern.
Yep. And thank you for letting us ask, you know, questions from Cartwright's perspective and saying it's anti-view.
No,
I really
thought Holly was going to be here. That's what I thought. I thought, you know, it was like going to be more of a debate or, you know, but it's good.
Maybe next time.
It's good next time. Invite us both. But, you know, Holly and I have done this dance before, and he knows where I stand. And it usually comes down to that perspective argument, you know.
Yeah.
And like I use, like, the parents feel one way about that 18-year-old.
Well,
Holly feels another way.
As a parent, you can imagine both sides, right? You can imagine your kid being in that situation. You can imagine your kid being the victim.
Being a victim, yeah.
And
yeah.
So it's a you know, it's a difficult situation. So I just thank you all.
All
really,
right.
Thank you.
We
so very much appreciate it. We'll adjourn.
Will we adjourn?
I'll second that. All in favor?
Aye.
We are adjourned.